ID, the Future, a podcast about evolution and intelligent design.
What do South Africa and missing persons have to do with intelligent design? We'll find out in just a moment. Welcome to ID the Future. I'm Robert Crowther with Center for Science and Culture, and today I have a really special guest. Longtime listeners will know him and maybe have wondered whatever happened to that guy. Joining me now is Casey Luskin.
Hi, Rob. It's a little bit surreal to be on the podcast with you today, but it's great to be here.
Yeah, it is great to have you back on ID the Future. I say back because you haven't done one of these podcasts for about 5 years. So let's start with the obvious question. Where have you been for the last 4.5, 5 years, and what have you been doing?
Yeah. So I was living abroad in South Africa doing a PhD in geology, basically fulfilling a goal I'd had my entire life, which was to further my studies and get a PhD in geology.
Wow, that is fantastic. And it took, almost 5 years to do it. Is that pretty average for a PhD?
I would say so. I mean, it depends on different countries have different systems of PhDs. South Africa uses the British system, which is used in obviously the UK, South Africa, Australia, India, where it tends to take maybe more like 2 to 5 years for a PhD. Whereas in the US, the system is a little bit different and it can be more like a 4 to 9 year for a science PhD. And it has to do with just the way they structure the program and when you actually start your thesis project. But I would say in South Africa, yeah, my program was pretty typical.
Pretty typical. Okay. So tell us where you were at school specifically and a little bit about the topic of your PhD. Was it related to intelligent design?
Yeah. So the PhD took me to the University of Johannesburg, which is obviously in the city of Johannesburg, and it was not related to intelligent design. My thesis focused on studying the early plate tectonic history of South Africa through paleomagnetism, which is a subfield of geology that looks at the magnetic properties of rocks to try to determine essentially where on Earth those rocks were located at the time that they formed. So I studied a group of rocks called the Pongola Supergroup. They're about 2.95 billion years old, so they're pretty old. It's a major section of rocks in southeastern South Africa in the KwaZulu-Natal and Mpumalanga provinces, and they represent some of the first rocks in South Africa that are thought to have been developed and deposited on stable continental crust. So they're recording sort of the early crustal history of the Earth. And the question was to look at a huge group of volcanic rocks called the Insuzi Group and figure out where they were located at the time they formed, again, around 2.95 to 3 billion years ago. But no, my thesis was not related to intelligent design. I would say that it could have some implications for early Earth habitability. And my colleagues at the University of Johannesburg were fantastic people. They were aware, or at least many of them were aware of my ID views and also my prior work at Discovery Institute. But to my knowledge, they did not share them. And frankly, intelligent design really was not something that came up very much. They're first rate a geologist doing phenomenal research and great people who basically have nothing to do with intelligent design. But I had a great time doing the research there, and it was an experience I will treasure for my entire life.
Wow. Well, that sort of answers my second question, which is around kind of why South Africa. Obviously, you're studying tectonic plates in South Africa, so you're not going to go to Manitoba or somewhere to do that. So I know why you were there. And that's a pretty cool thing to be able to study all these rocks that are so old, and you got out in the field, so to speak, I'm guessing.
Yeah, I spent countless days and even weeks, or sometimes I guess months, tromping through snake-filled South African bush, had all kinds of crazy hazards that we encountered. But I do want to circle back, Rob, to something you said about, you know, why did I go to South Africa specifically? Because, I mean, you could study plate tectonics, if that's what you were interested in, through paleomagnetism, really anywhere on the Earth. But there were a couple reasons, and specifically, that I did choose to go to South Africa. One is that my wife's family is actually originally from South Africa, and we have a lot of extended family there. But second, South Africa is probably one of the, you could say, per capita, one of the geologically richest countries in the world. And it has a huge mining industry and a very well-developed national infrastructure for geological research. So it actually is a world-class place to do geological research. The University of Johannesburg in particular has a world-class geology department that's doing many forms of cutting-edge geology research. So it was a superb place to study, and there were lots of opportunities for collaborations and meeting other scientists, and just the research that's doing there was, I couldn't have asked for a better experience.
Well, that's great. South Africa is a bit far afield from Seattle or the west coast of the United States, where we've been spending a lot of time, your time working at Discovery and so on. What was it like living in South Africa? What was Johannesburg like and all of that?
So South Africa is a beautiful country with wonderful people, an incredibly rich and multicultural society. Cheerful vibes are everywhere, and also unmatched natural beauty, including incredible wildlife that I think testifies to nature's design. So South Africa is a very special place to me, but it is also a country of contradictions, I would say. The country, unfortunately, is still recovering from decades of the oppressive and racist apartheid regime, which really only fell in the mid-1990s. And although I would say most people there just want to get along, regardless of your race or your background, there is still really a horrific and almost shocking amount of economic inequality in the country that afflicts the African communities there. So it's a country of extreme wealth, extreme poverty. Some places are as glamorous as any first world country, and other parts have people living in third world conditions that are as primitive and dangerous as almost anywhere in the world. So I'm not going to sugarcoat this. Living in Johannesburg for a little over four years, we became accustomed, my wife and I, to being surrounded by the threat of serious crime and violence. But it's not all bad news. I mean, the people in South Africa, I can't overemphasize this, they're the most wonderful, caring, kind people that you could ever meet. The kind of people who will just take their shirts off their back to give them to you if you need help. And this is true regardless of, say, the socioeconomic or ethnic or whatever the background is of the person that you might meet. And I would say some other good news about South Africa is there is a very strongly growing Black middle class. I was very blessed to go to a very diverse church in South Africa and also meet numerous young, brilliant Black students who I TA'd for as a PhD student. And in many cases, through these experiences, I encountered many first-generation college students who are highly motivated and very bright, and they're going to help see Nelson Mandela's vision of a rainbow nation really come to pass. So I'm very hopeful as an outsider, you know, who is still trying to learn about the country. I am hopeful, I think, for the future of South Africa. It's going in a really good direction.
That's a great experience to be able to go and watch the development of the, you know, the changes that are getting better, the progress being made as it's happening. That's pretty cool. One other thing that Africa is famous for is its wildlife. Maybe you could tell us about any wildlife experiences you had or encounters while you were out doing research.
Oh my goodness. Yeah. We took quite a few trips to Kruger National Park, which is a place where you can see some of the best African wildlife, period, on a very, very good, tight budget. And you can kind of see the wildlife there in a DIY kind of fashion, safari DIY, you might say. But I think that the most incredible wildlife experience we had was at Pilanesberg National Park, where we actually got to see a giraffe giving birth. And we had a front row seat next to a bunch of wild zebra who were also very interested in observing the experience. But when discussing African wildlife, people often refer to the big five, the most famous five large mammals that are commonly seen. That would be elephants, lions, leopards, rhino, and buffalo. And if you go to the national parks there, you're pretty much guaranteed that you're going to see elephants and buffalo. We see a lot of those, but there's also a very high chance you're going to see lions and rhinos as well. Leopards are solitary, and they're a little bit harder to find, but with a little luck, you will see leopards too. Even the occasional non-big five mammals like a cheetah or a pangolin or porcupines. We saw all kinds of incredible wildlife while we were there. And so if you ever plan to go to South Africa, please feel free to shoot me an email and I can definitely offer some tips for the trip.
Yeah, all the best watering holes to see wildlife.
There you go. Exactly. Or places not to go to, you know, to avoid going if you don't want to get eaten or something. Yeah.
Right. South Africa, besides its wildlife, famous for its fossils and hominid fossil sites. I'm assuming you probably saw a lot of those while you were there.
Well, yeah. I mean, you kind of have to like find opportunities to go see these because they are open to the public. But sometimes if you want to go see them, you really need to find a way to get a tour. And through a few geology conferences, I was able to actually get some direct tours of multiple fossil sites, including the Cradle of Humankind, which is the famous region just north of Johannesburg, where many of the world's most famous hominid fossil finds have been found. I even got to assist with some paleomagnetic field work at a hominid site at the Cradle of Humankind, which is pretty cool. I would say South Africa probably has the best hominid fossil museum in the world. It's called Meropeng at the Cradle of Humankind. I went there quite a few times. And there's another spectacular hominid fossil museum at the University of Witwatersrand called the Origins Museum, which was just a couple miles away from where I lived, and I got to go there quite a bit. So yeah, I had many opportunities to visit some fossil hominid sites while I was there. Even the Taung site, where the famous Taung child skull was there, I got to kind of visit that, saw it from the outside, but it was really amazing. I also was really had some great opportunities to hear lectures from paleoanthropologists while I was there. A number of lectures that I heard on Homo naledi, lectures that were open to the public. And also, I kind of got to know some folks who were involved with research and had a second or third row seat, you might say, to watch some of the drama that unfolded when Homo naledi was dated in 2017, which of course, as our listeners may recall, was dated to 250 to 350,000 years in age, which made it about 10 times too young to be a human ancestor. And this was a real disappointment for some folks in the evolutionary biology community. But it was very interesting to see, you know, the scientific process at work and people using various dating techniques to get a good date on that fossil. They did some fantastic geological work. It was not easy. And I really respect the people who did that research.
Yeah. It's interesting because your specific research in your PhD was not necessarily tied to intelligent design, but you are somewhere, as you mentioned, you know, the Cradle of Humankind, the Origins Museums. I'm sure there's a lot of fossils and various things like you just explained that come up. Are there any discussions about intelligent design that you heard in South Africa? Did you encounter any ID proponents?
Yeah, I mean, I would say that in some ways, the intelligent design evolution debate is not as big a thing in South Africa as it is in the United States or the West. But there certainly are a lot of people that are interested in intelligent design. In fact, there's a growing network of campus university groups in South Africa that are very interested in ID and hosted many intelligent design speakers on South African universities while I was there. I didn't do very much of that speaking because I was very focused on my PhD and really that was not what I was there to do. But I can say that there's a lot of interest in ID in South Africa, and speakers from both inside and outside the country are promoting a lot of awareness for what ID is in South Africa. So I don't know what the future holds, but I can say that it is an issue that people are becoming more and more interested in there. And with all the speakers that are being brought in from around the world, I wouldn't be surprised if this becomes more and more of a discussion topic in that country in the coming years.
Yeah, it's becoming more and more a discussion topic in a lot of countries outside of the United States, the UK, and various countries where it has been a longer running discussion or debate, if you will, I guess. But it is growing in prominence all over the place, obviously South Africa as well. When you're there doing your PhD, what did you learn in South Africa about just general scientific research, not necessarily related to this, but...
Yeah, so, I mean, I think it's safe to say that I learned that, I mean, I think it's something that I already knew, but some things you don't really learn them until you do them. And I learned that scientific research is not easy. And I mean, I think I knew that in my head, but some things you have to do it to appreciate just how tough it is. And my project involved months and even years of field work and lab work, data analysis, write-up, and the project certainly had its ups and downs. There was excitement, there was fun, there was blood, there was tears, there was sweat, there was near madness, there was sheer terror, and there was utter boredom. So, I mean, the entire spectrum of emotions took place. But, I mean, I think some of the excitement and terror is worth mentioning because there were multiple times where either I was doing field work or I was helping other people doing field work around rivers or areas where there were signs warning of crocodiles and pythons and hippos and leopards and other hazards. So you just kind of like say a prayer. One time we had a guy standing guard. I think he had a gun watching while we were collecting samples. I mean, to make sure that there were no animals around. So, but this is actually not that weird in South Africa. These are pretty normal experiences that people have when they go to certain places. You just got to be careful. I had other fun experiences like getting tick bite fever or getting caught in a lightning storm. And, you know, when you're carrying a metal rock hammer and pounds of rocks on your back, that's a little bit disconcerting. Angry farmers threatening to shoot me because they thought I was trespassing on their land. I think I mentioned earlier the tromping through miles of snake-infested bush. I think they kind of get a little bit of imagine what it's like to be in an army where you don't know if you're about to step on a landmine with your next step. I mean, you don't know if your next step is going to be on a snake or what. So you kind of just try not to think about it, basically. And at the end of the day, you thank God that you made it through the day and you still have all your limbs intact. And I'm not saying that people get hurt all the time in South Africa, but you do hear stories. So it's just, it's always there in the back of your mind. Then there was the boredom and the tears. Certainly anyone who's done a PhD has experienced machinery and the instrument breakdown. And my PhD was no exception. Spending many, many days and nights in small windowless rooms doing experiments, running, measuring rocks. That was not fun. It definitely takes a psychological toll when you're doing that for months on end. But it's just, again, part of the experience. And I'm not saying I'm anything special here. Anybody who's done a PhD has done this kind of stuff. And it's just a lot of grind, basically. But I think for me, the madness really set in during a period of some broken machinery. I tried to make good use of that time. I did some field work, but I also started writing some Python code and ended up writing over 30,000 lines of Python code to create new software tools for generating paleomagnetic diagrams. And it really starts to get inside your head. And my family bought me a t-shirt that year for Christmas that said, "I dream in Python." Because for months, literally your brain doesn't turn off. You're thinking about code all the time. And in the end, it was worth it because I was able to use this program to generate, you know, a large majority of the diagrams in my PhD thesis. Coding too much and it really starts to mess with you. So, but again, I just want to say, you know, none of this stuff that I just said makes me unusual. It's just like every other geologist who has done field work and lab work and data analysis. And in the end, it was immensely rewarding because we were able to test some really fascinating hypotheses about whether the Capval Craton, which is a region of very ancient crust in southern Africa, was connected to Western Australia at about 3 billion years ago. It's really rewarding to be able to, you know, see the fruits of your labor, being able to test these hypotheses, and in the end, come up with something that is scientifically interesting.
Yeah. You said that this isn't too unusual for a PhD, but I do have to point out that it might be unusual. You said it was fun, I think, to get tick bite fever.
No, that was not fun. No, tick bite fever, it probably sounds worse than it really is. It's kind of like a really serious case of the flu, and if you get the right antibiotics, you can get over it in a few days. But, I mean, it's not a joke. Good. Like, you're feeling it. Your fever is, it's up there. Everybody I know, I can't think of a single person in my department who was, like, coming from abroad who didn't get it at some point. It's just, it's like a rite of passage.
Well, you have done that PhD now, so you know all the ups, downs, boredom, madness, everything you just mentioned that all pretty much people doing PhDs go through, I think, anyhow. And the claim is often made that non-PhDs, people who haven't gone through that perhaps, or non-experts, have no place talking about science. Do you agree with this now that you have a PhD? Are you going to tell people without PhDs that they should not be talking about science? Do you agree with this after doing a PhD?
Look, a PhD is no cakewalk, and it was the most mentally and emotionally exhausting intellectual activity I've done in my entire life, and it's a serious venture. But after doing a PhD, I am more convinced than ever that you do not need a PhD to be able to do good science and to be able to speak cogently on scientific topics. And don't get me wrong, there's a lot of smart people out there with PhDs, but there's a saying that I've heard that I totally agree with. It says that science is 50% luck, 50% hard work, and the rest brains. So look, earning a PhD is not easy, but I'm more convinced than ever that it's not a litmus test for whether you're intelligent, whether you understand science, whether you have the ability and right to cogently speak in public about science, or whether your views about science are ultimately correct. A PhD is a big thing, but you do not need a PhD to be able to know what you're talking about and have the right to speak on scientific topics. I'm more convinced of that than ever after doing this PhD.
Well, that's good to know. I agree with you. I think there are lots of smart non-PhD people that understand science and have a unique view of it that is worth listening to and hearing from them as well. Unfortunately, that's all the time that we have for today with this podcast, but I will be talking more with Dr. Luskin on future ID the Future episodes. So be sure to tune into those if you want to hear more about his time in South Africa and some of the work he did there, as well as what the future holds for him and his return to Discovery Institute. Thanks for being with us today, Casey.
Thanks a lot, Rob. It's great to be back with you. And I look forward to becoming a part of the ID Future podcast again, and also being on the other side of the chair doing some interviewing like what you're doing. So thanks a lot.
Yeah. All right. Please be sure to visit idthefuture.com for more great podcasts about evolution and intelligent design. That's idthefuture.com. For the CSC, I'm Robert Crowther. Thanks for joining us.
Visit us at idthefuture.com and intelligentdesign.org. This program is copyright Discovery Institute and recorded by its Center for Science and Culture.